So my talk is a joint work with Bernard Dacronia. I am going to mainly talk about Michel Truss's and skip the part on extension of vector field. The novelty is more on Michel Truss's. And there is a connection between both topics. So let me start with some basic notation. So assume that I have AB, two vector, then A tensor B is the rank one matrix whose components are AIBJ, and A cross product B is twice the anti-symmetric part of this matrix, which is AIBJ minus AJ BI. So I am going to denote by A hat, A over the dump of A. So assume that omega is a set, subset of RD. Usually I am going to assume that this is a connected set. And assume that we have a D measure from omega to RD. So I mean each element of omega, I am going to associate a value, C of S, but I will allow this to be a measure instead of a function. Then divergence of C is defined by this will hold for every phi in C1 of omega bar. So this is a way to write divergence taking into consideration boundary measure. So instead of writing divergence of C equal to F in omega and equal to something on the boundary of omega, I write it in a compact way by taking my test function in C1 of omega bar. So assume that I have a curve, ellipsis curve, or a W2 infinity curve. No, I don't impose that it vanishes on the boundary. Say it again. Yes. For instance, if instead of writing that, if I take so if I take C equal to A, the D dimensional Lebesgue measure plus C nu, the D minus 1 Lebesgue measure on the boundary of omega, then this way of writing is, this is a compact way of writing that system. So assume that I have a curve of C in omega, and denote by TC, the unit tangent vector at each point. So this vector is defined at up to a sign, which will not matter because I am going to consider TC cross TC, which is a sign independent. I multiply that by the H1 measure restricted to the curve. and write negative divergence of this, which means I am writing the divergence of each row of that matrix. What one gets is negative kappa, where this is the curvature, and C, this is the curvature vector, so that this product is independent of the parametrization, plus the Dirac mass at B, the tangent vector at B, minus the Dirac mass at A, the tangent vector at A. And I need to divide that by the length of C. In particular, if we have a straight line from A to B, then this is zero, and what we get here is 1 over the length of AB, delta C, delta B, minus delta A, B minus A hat. And this represents the following beam. Where this surface is proportional to the coefficient which I am going to put. If I put a coefficient here, that will be lambda over A minus B. So this is the identification which are usually made in so TC is the unit vector, the unit tangent vector at C. So that H1 is a one-dimensional Hausdorff measure. I get the curvature vector. Yes, plus the boundary term. Yes, so I am saying if I have a beam whose width is lambda divided by the distance from A minus B, these beams will be represented by that. Yes. Oh. We are in RB. Or if you want, if I write this, A minus B divided by the norm of A minus B, and I write lambda here, then I am saying if the cross-section is lambda, then these two objects are the same. Yes. So this is a matrix. Yes. So the divergence of a matrix is a vector whose first component is the divergence of the first row. The second component is the divergence of the second row, and so on. So this is a vector. This result is a vector. Yes. Yes. So I am going to, the identification is the strength is proportional to the intensity of the strength is proportional to the width of the beam. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, you'll be happier if I write H1 restricted to the to that, or if I assume that the curvature is zero outside the curve. Yes. Okay. So let me assume that you take the parametrization by Askelin. Then you differentiate twice this, and you get AC. Say it again. Oh. Yes. Okay, so before having been given a precise formulation of the variational problem, I am going to study. The rough explanation is the following. Assume that we are given a system of forces. So one force consists of its point of application and a vector. So a force is represented if the point is M and this vector is Fm, the force is delta M Fm. A system of force, a simple system of force is, for instance, a combination is a combination of forces of this form. Or in general, one can write the following definition. What is a force? I give myself F1, Fd, which are measure on Rd, and I set F to be F1, Fd. So that is, in general, what I call a force. Now, if I impose the extra condition that the first moment of the force is zero, so this means that I am integrating, I am computing the measure of each component. This is a vector in Rv. And so here I mean the zero moment. The first moment is also zero. Then I will say that the system of force is equilibrated. Or I will say I have a system of force in equilibrium. For instance, you can check easily the following. If F is a beam, this is equilibrated. So the problem we want to study is the following. Assume that we are given a system of forces. We want to decompose this system into beams. And we want to minimize the volume of the beam. And the question is there a minimizer which is obtained as a linear combination of beams? Yes. So according to that, this is the integral of Fi Fj minus Fj Fi is zero for every ij. So, yes.
Of everything that you know, you are
We have minus divergence of what?
The divergence is equal to pressure for some Q of T. So then they integrate it. Try to see if it's equilibrium and integrate. Of course it is
not. No, the equilibrium in, maybe you are referring to V. Maybe you are referring to that as a equilibrium equation. But I am calling this, when this property is satisfied, I say that I have an equilibrated system of forces. What is removing a translation? No. However, what you are saying is possible if I am going to introduce later displacement, and if you add something of this form, if you take any displacement u and you add that to it, and you consider the work performed at that. If I have an equilibrated system of force, it will not depend on A and B. Okay, a way to convince you that your argument will not work is the following. Assume that I have a system of forces which we have two points of application. For the moment to be zero, they have to be parallel. So no matter what coordinate you take, you will never get that. Then I am changing the force. If I have this. If I have that, I don't have the same force. You are saying if I take F A plus C delta A F B plus C delta B. So the first natural question is, assume that I am given an equilibrated system of force. Do I know that I can write it as a linear combination of beams before I start minimizing a functional which depends on how I write this linear combination of beams? I am not going to give here a complete proof of that, but I am just going to say what are the important steps to prove that such a decomposition always holds. So the proof will be the following. Assume that I have an equilibrated system of force in RD. I am going to prove by induction on D that I can decompose that into a finite combination of beams. So let us consider the following. Assume that these are part of my forces. What I am going to do is I am going to consider the straight line parallel to these two forces and the intersection of this straight line with the plane. So this is going to give me two points here. Say it again. I want to give a proof on the dimension. So I'm going to project on this plane, this hyperplane. So my statement is the following. I have an equilibrated system of forces. I want to prove that I can write it as a linear combination of beams. I want to write a proof on the dimension. So if I can write my forces as, if I can write F as an equilibrated system of forces in this space, plus something which I know how to decompose, then this is the first step for my induction argument. And I want to, what I am trying to do there is how I reduce my proof from this case to that case. So assume that the path of the forces are like that. Then I am going to substitute this force by three forces. And of course, these new forces are equivalent to the original one. And here I have introduced a beam. And I can just ignore the black part and take into consideration only the blue part. And here I do the same. Now I have reduced the study to the case where the application of the forces are in RD. However, I don't know yet that these forces are in RD minus 1. I don't know yet that these forces are in RD minus 1. So let us study this second case. So assume that this is the situation I am in. What I am going to do, I am going to choose any arbitrary point outside this hyperplane and draw a straight line connecting each of the points in the plane to that point. One can check that the resultant of the forces here will be zero. So I have introduced one, two, three beams. And I am left with forces whose points of application are in the plane, but also these forces are horizontal. And so I have reduced this study to that study. So one can combine, these are the two important cases to consider to show that you can prove by induction that any equilibrated system of force can be written as a linear combination of beams. And one can do this reduction by controlling how far this point is from the hyperplane, meaning that I can write a linear decomposition which whose coefficient depend on the total variation of the forces, but also the first moment of the forces. Yes. So you can check that at each step. An easy way to see is, to see that is the following. If I add a beam to an equilibrated system of force, I get another system which is equilibrated. So what I've been doing there is I've been removing beams, and so I don't change that property. So Michel's problem is the following. Assume that we are given a system of force in equilibrium, so I mean equilibrated system of forces, with specified point of application. Assume that we are given an elastic material with an allowable range for the uniaxial stress. So this means that I am saying how much I can stretch or compress the material without breaking it. It is not unique. Otherwise, we cannot look for a minimizer, right? Once we have one, we have a minimizer if it was unique. I mean, why homogeneous? Yes. So the only thing which is relevant is you want to use beams, and you are told how long you can stretch them or compress them. Yes. Yes. So the goal is to design a frame of minimal volume made of bar of a given material such that the given forces produce axial stresses within the allowable range. So the variational problem I want to consider is the following. Given F, I am going to find real number lambda ij, and I am going to find point such that F can be written as the sum of lambda I, j, ai minus aj divided by the norm of ai minus aj, delta ai minus delta aj. So to each of these decomposition, I am going to associate the following cost. This cost will depend on lambda ij. It will also depend on the AI, that is the sum of lambda ij, the absolute value, AI minus AJ. So the number of points I am allowed to use is not specified. I can use any number of points. And so the problem is to know if there is a minimal decomposition, if I can choose lambda ij, aij, such that this is minimized. So let us write a set a decomposition in a very simple case. Assume that my system consists of three forces. These two have the same intensity, and this one is twice the intensity of these two. So I can do the following. The horizontal, the vertical force at the left is decomposed into these two forces. So this sum is going to give the original vertical force. Once I introduce this force to have a beam, I introduce another force here, which is parallel to that. I do the same on the right-hand side. So what I've done eventually, I introduce 50 forces here, and I need to balance that. So to balance these new two forces I have introduced, I need now to introduce that, so that the resultant here is zero. So when I superpose these two bars, this is what I get. And the cost of the volume associated to such a decomposition is written that way if I take the length A0 to A3 as the unit length. I have what? Yes, let me draw it here. So I have this, that, and that. Yes. Yes. Okay, so I do. I decompose this one that way, which means I am putting a beam here. And so for this to be a beam, I have to equilibrate that with such a force. I do the same on this side. Which I calibrate by that force. Now I have changed the forces here, and I need to correct that for that I introduce that force. And so what I do next is this has to be part of a beam. I am going to equilibrate that with this. Actually, my lengths are not correct, but this is the correct picture. The last one. Yes. So here I have a representation of the forces, and if I put the forces there, it will be two. It will be too much information. Yes. Say it again. Okay, so what I've done is here, I just said how I decompose this and how I decompose that. And I didn't complete. Yes. That is here. And the top one is there. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes. You have three beams in tension and three beams in compression. Okay, so next I am going to write a variational problem as which appear in the literature. So set sigma to be the sum lambda ij ai minus aj tensor product ai minus aj, and the one-dimensional half-dot measure restricted to the segment ai aj, where this denotes the unit vector in the direction ai minus aj. So according to the computation here, and taking into account that the curvature is zero, one can check that this equation is equivalent to negative divergence of sigma equal to F. So I am going to introduce the following function. When I have a matrix psi, which is a D by D matrix, I call lambda I psi plus psi transpose over 2. This is a symmetric matrix, so it has the eigenvalues. The mass of this, I call it rho of psi, which you can check that this is the supremum psi b plus b being rd, where I impose that the Euclidean norm of b is less than 1. The polar of this function, sigma rd cross d, rho naught of sigma, is the sup psi sigma, subject to the constraint that rho of psi is less than or equal to 1. And in fact, you can check that this is plus infinity if sigma is not symmetric. And this is equal to the sum of the eigenvalue of sigma with absolute value. Now I have two functions which is homogeneous of degree 1. When I write the integral of rho of sigma, where sigma is a measure, by this I mean the integral of rho d sigma d mu, where mu is any measure such that sigma is absolutely continuous with respect to mu, and one can check that this representation does not depend on the mu I use, and so I can forget about the right hand side. Now sigma is as written there, one can check that the cos lambda ij ai, which I wrote there, is nothing but the integral of rho of sigma. So the variational problem we consider is the infimum over sigma, the integral of rho of sigma, such that sigma satisfies 1. which sum? Sorry, no, from I to D, from I to D. Yes, those are the eigenvalue. If sigma is symmetric, and if sigma is not symmetric, one can check that this is plus infinity. Yes, yes. So I mean that sigma is of this form, and that holds, which I can write in a compact where this sigma is a f, and sigma is a specific combination.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. So I am allowed to take the point anywhere in the space.
How many points?
Yes, infinitely many.
So you have infinitely many variations.
I have infinitely many variables. Yes, it will turn out that it is convex, as we see. So I need to. This integral.
Yeah.
So I say that if sigma is a measure, I take any mu such that each component of sigma is absolutely continuous with respect to mu. For instance, take the sum of the total variation. And so this makes sense. And then I said that what is on the right-hand side does not depend on the mu I take. The expression is the same because rho is homogeneous of degree 1. And so I am going to use this notation. So the following has been observed by Michel when he stated his problem. So he considers this very simple example of system of force and try to find the optimal decomposition. So I ask you, take a guess, what do you think the optimal will be? And usually, unless you know the answer, most mathematicians get the wrong guess. So the mechanical engineer will tell you, yes, this is what you should get. But when you ask them to prove it, then they cannot prove that why this is the optimum. And one interesting point is now we know how to prove what the optimum are, but we don't know how Michel got it, which means if I give you any admissible stress or sigma, how do you improve it? I mean, what algorithm you use? How do you move the bar around to get a better volume? Okay. So actually, why this row? Why this row is a... Yes. Yes. So one thing I kept is the following. When you look at this problem, of course, there you have many candidates of rho, rho you can take. But when you look at the relax of this problem, which means that you take the closure of all the sigma, which are this form, you see that the relax gives you exactly that function. So I am not proving that here, but I can give you convincing arguments, short arguments, why this will be the relaxation of the original program.
So, for instance, if you take signal this form,
yes.
This means that almost everywhere, sigma is of
90. Exactly. And then you are going to check that if sigma was not of rank 1. Because I can write this as I can write this that way. So what I mean is, although I have this intersection here, instead of assuming that I have 2 bars, I can write this in fact as a 4 bar. Okay, so let me tell you what I am saying. I am saying that this and that are exactly the same thing. Okay, so even if I am in this situation where I at some point I have something which is not of rank 1, I can always write it this way.
I mean, you can also say that the point
has either 0 or 2. But you cannot do that in general. Assume that I have this, where this fills the whole plane. Then I cannot say that the point of intersection is of 0 measure. So let us start with an admissible stress. So here I did not represent all the forces to make the picture simple. So what is in red are the bar in tension, and what is in black are the bar in compression. Okay, so yes, the dot is in tension, and the bolt is in compression. So call this sigma. Then I improve that by adding more bar in this specific way. So I don't move this far, I leave this four square, and these 3 points are on a circle. I am going to add 2 more points on that circle and draw these 2 line segments. And I continue doing that. When I have 15 points, this is what I get. When n goes to plus infinity, this is what you get. And so there is no minimizer in the set of stress which consists of finitely many bars. Say it again. So if you show that, if you ask them, then they will draw you this picture because they've seen that often. Yes, they will say, not only they will say that, but they will say that for this specific system of force, this is the optimal. And then if you want to understand how do I get, so when I have this, what makes me think that this is what I have to do next? I mean, why didn't I move any bar of the square? And I never got a satisfactory answer, which means if you ask me, I mean, they have algorithms which is going to give you the stress. But That is how much we understand. And at least when you look at this example, you see that you have a part of the stress which consists of something which is absolutely continued with respect to the two-dimensional half-block measure, and something which is one-dimensional with respect to the half-block measure. And so you don't hope any smoothness property. You don't hope that your sigma will be smooth. So not only Michel ended up with this picture, he said that the following rule holds. If I am looking for an optimal sigma, all I have to do is to find two systems of curves which are orthogonal. I need two systems of curves which are orthogonal. If along one system I can have only curves which are in tension, and along some the other class I can have curves which are in compression, and if in addition I know that there exists a displacement, if I know that there exists a displacement u from omega bar to rv such that the eigenvalue, so what is E of u naught? This is the symmetric part of the gradient of u naught. If I know that this is satisfied, and I know that this family are the line of principal action for that matrix, then my sigma is optimal. So looking for sigma that are optimal is equivalent to looking for a particular class of system of curves which are orthogonal. So in the plane, at least the system of curves satisfying that property are called Henke-Prague nets. So a question of interest is to prove Michel's prediction. And one of the main difficulty when you try to prove Michel's prediction is this condition only ensures you that u naught is W1P for all P if you use Korn inequality, but assume that you even have u naught to be of class C infinity. Then you write E of u naught. You decompose that. You know that you can write such a decomposition. But what you don't know is these expressions, for instance, the AI, you don't know if they are smooth or even Lipschitz. For instance, take a simple example. Take u naught to be the identity. You may choose the AI so that the AI are Lipschitz vector field. But you may choose the AI such that they are not Lipschitz vector field. If you take any system of orthogonal curve, then there will be equal to, with lambda I equal to 1, there will be equal to the identity matrix. So what we try to do is see how you can avoid the smokiness property and still prove the existence of a line of principal action. So this is what I was saying. I was saying that even if I have identity, if U naught of S was S, which is a C infinity, this is a C infinity map. Yeah, so he was saying, assume that I have the forces which are not singular, and then they produce a U naught which is C infinity. And I am saying you not being C infinity does not resolve the issue. Because when I give you E of U not, which is here, is the identity. Because I have a specific example, I know how to choose the AI so that they are smooth. Right? I can choose the AI to be a constant. But I can also choose them to be nowhere differentiable. At each point, I can always change my orthonormal basis. The point where the eigenvalue are equal, for instance, exactly. Right? You don't know what to call the first and what to call the second. Yes. You order and get a Lipschitz. I don't know. I don't know how you can do that. Yes, that is a good question. So what is hidden behind that is the following. So when you write this problem, then one can check that the dual to that is the supremum, the integral over displacement u from omega to rb fu, subject to the constraint that rho of e of u is less than 1 almost everywhere. So minimizing the volume is equivalent to maximizing the work. So this is a very well-known principle, which is not difficult to prove.
So you said minimizing the volume?
Is equivalent to maximizing the work.
Duality.
Say it again?
Duality.
Yes, this is a duality result. If rho naught is the maximum, then if rho naught is the maximum, what I wrote in the sigma naught is the minimum here, then the relation is, there is a relation with rho naught and sigma naught. So let me try to show one side of this duality. So assume that I take any arbitrary sigma satisfying this, and I take any arbitrary u satisfying that. Then I have the integral of fu is, I replace f by negative divergence of sigma u. I integrate by parts to get sigma u. But because sigma is symmetric, this is sigma e of u. I am going to use that rho of A, rho naught of B, is always greater than AB. This is easy to check, to say that this is less than the integral of rho naught of sigma, rho of E of u. But if rho of E of u is less than 1, then this is less than rho naught of sigma. And so this functional is always below that one. If I can find a u naught and a sigma naught such that equality holds, it means that u naught maximizes this function and the sigma naught minimizes that function. So if equality will hold, it means that in particular here equality will hold and there equality will hold. So it means that rho of E of u naught must be equal to 1 sigma naught almost everywhere. And one can characterize the point, such the matrices such that you have this equality. When you have two matrices, this equality holds if and only if they have the same eigenvectors, first. And second, the positive eigenvector of the first matrix correspond exactly to the positive eigenvector of the second matrix, and the negative eigenvector of the first matrix are the correspond to the eigenvector of the second matrix. So this explains why the line of principal action, the principal line of E of u naught, must be the principal line of sigma. So let me try and. No, take for instance A to be a vector E1 cross E1 and B to be E1 cross E1. So you can write that plus 0 E orthogonal cross E orthogonal. And so the eigenvalue are not the same. And you can still check that this equality holds. Okay, so since we are over time, let me say briefly what we do to go around the smoothness problem. So let us see what happens when we have a finitely many bar. So define for any vector field psi from omega to Rd cross Rd, define the following. Xc will be, so I'm going to call X the set of Lipschitz curve in omega bar. So in fact, if you take a curve which is W11, you can reparameterize that curve by the arc length and get then obtain a Lipschitz curve. So going from W11 to Lipschitz is not a big restriction. And when I consider the curve of the Lipschitz curve, I am going to always assume that they have a constant speed, and this speed is the length. So actually, what I mean here is the set of R in W1 infinity of 0, 1 omega bar, such that R dot is a constant. And this constant is necessarily the total length. I am going to define H from S to R by the following. H psi of C is the average of C, CC, of CC. And so one can see that this sigma is a way of writing sigma psi. If I integrate that over omega, this is the integral over x d gamma h psi of c, c, where gamma is a measure. So in this particular case, gamma is the sum of lambda ij. Actually, I am going to multiply by the length, ai minus aj. The Dirac mass, the segment ai, aj. Then one last word. We check the following. So we say that negative divergence of gamma equal to F if and only if the integral of H E of U D gamma equal to the integral of F U for every U. And we check that the infimum of the total variation of gamma, such that negative divergence of gamma is F, is the supremum, the integral of F of U, or E of U, is less than 1. And when you take the gamma optimal, it gives you all the properties you are looking for.